Hey, folks, time again for Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here, no theme music because I want to tell you up front that this is an encore presentation of Word Balloon going back to 2005. It's a great interview that I did with Joe Casey. This was an interesting time because Godland, his great series with Tom Scioli, was just coming out. Also at the time, Joe was involved with conversations with Matt Fraction online at Comic Book Resources. They were called the Basement Tapes. And maybe deep in my mind, it made me think when I named the Bendis tapes that, but this is so far back before I actually knew Matt Fraction that I refer to him as Matt Fracton. Yeah, nice going, John. Good conversation with Joe. We talk about his work on Superman, on Batman, the Avengers, and a lot of topics. I think you're going to enjoy it. Speaking of Matt Fraction, I've got a new thread up at wordballoon.com that is open because Matt is taking questions from you. So many things happening with X-Men Second Coming, his run on Thor, which will begin later in the year, and Iron Man 25 is coming up, a pivotal issue with the heroic age on its way. So neat stuff happening, lots to talk about with Fraction, and you are going to get a chance to ask Matt questions as well. Come to wordballoon.com. That's the place to put your questions, either on my message board or right at wordballoon.com in the thread that says questions for Matt Fraction. So, wanted to let you know about that up front. But for now, let's turn things over to the old Word Balloon theme music and Joe Casey on this special edition of Word Balloon.
Welcome to Word Balloon, the comics conversation show. This is John Suntress. Whether it's in his own books or as part of his weekly column, The Basement Tapes, co-written with Mac Fracton at the Comic Book Resources website, writer Joe Casey has kept one foot in the mainstream with his work on characters like Superman, Batman, G.I. Joe, and the Avengers, and experimented with original concepts like Automatic Kafka, Code Flesh, and his new monthly from Image Comics, co-created with artist Tom Scioli, Cosmic Adventure in the Jack Kirby tradition, Godland.
I've known Eric Larson for quite a few years now. When he took on the publisher gig at Image, to me it was sort of like getting the green light to do something at Image again. When he took over, I just called him up and I said, hey, congrats on the gig, and I'm ready to do something for you guys. I'm, you know, the energy is right. Let's do it. I had just sort of called him up almost just more as a congratulatory call than anything else. I didn't really have anything specifically in mind to do. I sort of asked him, you know, how are you going to go about this gig? I mean, is it going to be the same as before, where at Image you generally bring projects to Image as fully formed as you possibly can in terms of having your, you know, collaborators all lined up and the whole nine yards? And Eric was very open about saying, look, I know artists that haven't hooked up with a writer yet or haven't found the right project, or artists that he really liked but didn't think could maybe handle a title on their own. Okay. And that's where Tom Scioli came from. And I had known Tom's work already. So when Eric brought him up as like a guy that he'd been in contact with and wanted to work with but wanted to find the right project for Tom to do at Image, I was down right away. I mean, I was surprised that Tom was open to the idea. I mean, Tom's a writer himself. He writes his own material. But once we got together and started sort of bouncing ideas back and forth and bouncing our influences back and forth, because you look at Tom's work and you know right away where he comes from. You know what his influences are. You know what he's into. I'm into that same stuff, so we got on like a house on fire pretty much right off the bat, and the ideas and the characters and the type of comic that we wanted to do was settled pretty quickly, you know, and then it was just a matter of ideas back and forth, riffs and character designs and ideas that he had and ideas that I had, and pretty soon we had a series, we had characters, we had a direction that we wanted to go, we had an approach. It fell together pretty quickly, you know.
It's a great production, and I'm a big fan. And what I like is, too, all the advance notice that you put out there and Eric put out there is coming to light. These are self-contained issues in a lot of ways. I mean, this is really one of the best setup issues that gives you basically what you're working with to get you interested, plus gives you a pretty complete story in that great cosmic tradition of the late 60s and early 70s.
Well, first issues are very important. In a very competitive marketplace, you've got to hook readers with everything you got right off the bat, and the whole trend of the last couple of years of stretching stories out and really letting things breathe, which can be dramatic in its own way, it's fine if you're doing a Spider-Man story where you know that, you know, a bunch of people are going to buy it just because it's Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a brand new concept and you're really trying to grab a readership right off the bat and find some stability in this marketplace, you got to go both guns blazing right from the start, you know.
And you guys did. I mean, and you know, it's funny, these are different characters, but as you said, I mean, clearly your inspirations and Tom's inspirations are evident right there from your first words of True Believers, and also the great skyscapes that we get of outer space from Tom. We're in for a good ride, but I would say not only some marvelous cosmic scenes, to use a phrase, but also what I really like is I see in your main character a lot of Major Matt Mason. Now, I know you're a G.I. Joe writer, but I have a feeling you and I are around the same age, and I was always a Major Matt Mason guy.
Yeah, it's very much that straight-edge hero type, which hopefully as the series goes on, because I just can't help it. I mean, it's the kind of writer I am. I mean, there'll be a bit of subversion of that straight-arrow kind of guy.
Well, that's what we're hoping for. That's
yeah, I mean, that's what makes it interesting, is to take a template and veer away from it in certain ways and bring something new to the party. The cosmic epic is, in a way, in comic books, its own subgenre.
Sure.
And the best part about it is it's an umbrella for any idea that you can come up with. I mean, no idea is too surreal, no idea is too wacky. There's no story that we can tell in this arena that doesn't fit. I mean, that was sort of the appeal. I think that's the appeal of it for Tom as well, is that it's a great playground to come up with anything that your imagination can come up with. You know, there's really no limitations on what this book can contain. And hopefully people will get into it on that level, just to see what happens next and to see what we're going to come up with next.
You guys also got a great colorist, and I think that is key. And you know, that clearly accents a lot of the panels and a lot of the tone of the book. Can you talk about your colorist?
Well, Bill Crabtree, he came in and saved the day for us. We had another colorist that we were all excited about, a good colorist, but sort of at the very last minute, he was not able to do the book, and we were all like, oh, no. We didn't want to be the typical story of, you know, announcing a series, and then the series is late. I mean,
sure.
It's just, you know, it happens all the time for all kinds of reasons. And Tom and I are really far ahead on the book. I'm writing the 9th issue, and Tom is drawing issue 7 at the moment. So we were kicking ourselves that, oh, man, after all this time, after all the work we all put into it, that this would be the thing that makes us into that same old cliche. Luckily, Bill Crabtree was available. He came in and really just hit a home run just right off the bat, was really excited about coloring Tom's stuff. And his passion for the material is obviously evident in the work that he's doing. And that's the best you can hope for with any collaborators, that they bring their own passion to it and they bring their excitement to do it. And so now he was like the last piece of the puzzle. Now it's full steam ahead, and it's going to be great.
That's cool. And as you say, it looks like it's on schedule, and it will be a monthly.
Yeah.
And is it going to be ongoing, or are we looking
at... Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. And also, you know, like I said, each issue does kind of stand on its own. And I remember you saying, too, that these are all going to connect. Do you see these as sub-stories as part of 6-issue arcs or whatever?
Well, it's kind of two mints in one, in the sense that I'm very committed to give you everything that you could possibly want out of a single-issue comic book, but at the same time keep you hooked in, come back every month. And so it's the done-in-one mentality coupled with the I've sort of gotten away from the whole story arc mentality. The whole part
okay.
one of six is really boring to me now. So it's really just come back every month. That's all we ask. I mean, we'll give you something new. We'll give you a complete experience. We'll give you a lot to chew on, and hopefully the ride will just continue and get better and better and better without there being that sort of false demarcation of, well, 6 issues equals a trade paperback length, so at the end of issue 6 we'll have some sort of resolution. Forget all that. Let's just cut loose, and where we end up, we end up. That's, you know, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, they got 100 issues of the Fantastic Four working that way.
Absolutely. And also, I like the built-in marketing at the end of the first issue as well, where much in the tradition of Marvel, you've already painted the book a success, and because we, the public, demanded it,
oh,
issue
sure.
2 will follow.
Oh, it's great. I mean, the best thing about Image is that you really are in control of what your book is, the presentation of your book. And we're working with Richard Starkings and Comicraft, good friend of mine, who is handling the design work and the really putting the book together for us. I mean, Richard himself is sort of responsible for those ads in the back, and with issue 2 we'll have a letters page going, and you know, it's going to be the whole package. I mean, every issue is really going to be chock full of stuff. We've got pin-ups and all kinds of things, you know, in the back. It's really great. It turned out way better than even I imagined it would, and believe me, I can imagine quite a bit. So the fullness of the package has really been satisfying.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and really, if you haven't read Godland yet, by all means, pick it up. The first issue is out next issue next month, and it's a great series, and I'm really digging it.
Thanks.
Let's move on with another current book of yours, and that's The Intimates.
Sure.
How are things going with the series?
It's going. We're going to get 12 issues out of it, which, to be quite honest, is probably about 6 more than I expected.
Okay.
It's another book that's certainly different, and in the environment that we brought it out in, it was a risk, you know.
Sure.
The kind of comic book it is was somewhat of a risk, but I'm happy to take those risks, and to get 12 issues of something that I'm personally proud of is satisfying enough. And the people who read it and the people who buy it, they seem to get it and enjoy it, and it certainly lends itself to my, you know, status as a cult writer, so I'm quite happy about that.
No, well, you know, it's an interesting series, and as you say, you're right. I mean, the environment now is crowded with a lot of teen team-up books. It does have its own voice, though, in that wilderness, but you're right. I mean, I think it's butting heads with a lot of other projects out there as well.
Well, the reality of working, I mean, as much as The Intimates is a Wildstorm book, it really is a DC book. I mean, it's
sure.
part of DC Comics. And so working for what is essentially a big corporation, you take a big risk if you go into something with as much passion and commitment as you would a creator-owned book, as we do with Godland.
Mm-hmm.
You really are courting heartbreak there, because the corporation really will never have the passion for your project that you do. I'm one of those guys that is just hard-headed enough never to learn from my mistakes. I mean, I've had books like this before, even at Wildstorm, where I've just been completely committed as, you know, I mean, these books are my babies, and yet they're still subjected to the sort of harsh realities of that corporate infrastructure.
Yeah, the bottom line.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, which is always the enemy of art, but, you know, what are you going to do?
Sure, and as you say, too, Joe, I mean, you are the heartbreak kid when it comes to some of these series, because, you know, we can go right into Wildcats 3.0, which was an excellent series. I really enjoyed it, and I felt for you in terms of having to kind of wrap things up so quickly as you did. I'd like to talk about the themes of the book in general.
Sure.
First of all, what I really liked about it was your basic take on heroes and the whole idea of corporations and their real power over society, and I stress real power,
mm-hmm.
in ways that mainstream stories about LexCorp with Superman or Stark Enterprises in Iron Man, you know, never do. Can you give people, you know, a little bit of what they might have missed if they didn't catch Wildcats 3.0? I know you did some of 2.0, and certainly you used, you know, those basic Wildcats characters, but you took them into a different direction.
Well, Volume 2 was really about characters who were the sort of the hangover of sort of the boom of the Image days. I mean, the theme of Volume 2 was really character-based. So when it came to 3.0, the idea was born out of Volume 2, but what I really came to it thinking was, you know, corporations are really the biggest influences in our culture right now. But what generally happens, and if you have any sort of fiction about corporations, is that they're so huge, they're so powerful, that the tendency is to assign sinister intentions to these corporations, that they're really out to get us, they're really out to homogenize our lives and make things less unique and less specific, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, that everything's going to be branded with, you know, Coca-Cola is going to be everything, McDonald's,
yep.
Starbucks, you name it. And my opinion is a corporation is in a sense a non-specific entity. I mean, it's non-emotive. You can't just say all corporations are evil. It's what you make of it. So I thought, well, what's the difference really between a corporation and a superhero in terms of their influence on society? I mean, if Superman existed, he would have this massive influence on
sure.
the world we live in. And because it's a one person, and because of how Superman is characterized, we're more apt to assign good intentions to Superman as opposed to sinister intentions or evil intentions.
Mm-hmm.
So my 3.0 is basically saying, well, let's take the corporation and assign it all the good intentions that you would a Superman-type character or superhero-type character. And it was really the corporation as altruistic Superman. And all through the run, invariably the sentiment would be, Well, when is Jack Marla, who was the CEO character of the Halo Corporation, when is he going to turn evil? When are we going to see his true colors? When is the corruption going to come to the surface?
Right. When does power corrupt?
And I was above board the entire time saying, look, this series is optimistic in its outlook that it doesn't have to corrupt. I mean, Jack Marla is an alien character, so you don't have to assign sort of human weakness to the guy. That helped keep him altruistic. But, you know, it was funny to clue into readers' sort of cynicism about things as they kept asking that question. I kept refuting it in interviews. Every time I would promote the book, I would say, look, he's not evil. His intentions aren't evil. This is not a book where the other shoe is going to drop and suddenly everything you know is wrong.
I get you.
It's putting forth the idea that, you know, with all this power, how much good can you do? Now, that was very... It was very much a fantasy sort of series because we were dealing with things like an unlimited power source from another dimension and all that kind of stuff. But I think the ideals were still very relevant to the world that we live in, you know, and it's still that way where everyone is really assigning almost evil intentions to any, you know, name your corporation, you know.
Sure.
That they're taking over our lives and having this undue influence. Well, a corporation has as much influence over you as you let it have over you. Wildcats 3.0 was about saying, well, if we gave it good intentions, what effect would that have on the world? What effect would that have on people and the average guy in the street? What would be the socio-political effects? All that stuff was up for exploration, which made the series interesting for me.
Well, and I also think, unfortunately, you were a little ahead of your time because it would have been an interesting contrast if what we see now in documentaries like the Enron documentary about the smartest guys in the room,
right.
and really see that as a counterbalance. See, you're ahead of your time, Joe.
Well,
I mean, it was happening while the book was coming out.
Story of my life, John. I mean, but I don't mind that because somebody has to be the one to maybe try to go out there and present a new idea every once in a while. And there are worse reputations to have. You know? I mean, some of my favorite writers, some of my favorite works have been things that didn't catch on at the time they were new. I'm always pleased when I see comic books talk about things that I haven't seen, you know, or heard been talked about before. Some new area of culture or whatever, and it's just another example of how great the medium is that it can contain these ideas and present them in a way that is interesting. And I will say this, I don't write perfect comic books. I mean, there's every gig that I have is a learning experience. And take something like 3.0, if I were to do that again, I would certainly do it differently, taking into account what I learned doing it the first time around. Because people did have their opinions on maybe the book moved a little slow or whatever it was. And I wouldn't disagree with anybody's gripes about anything that I've ever done, because each gig is a learning experience, and I'm still trying to figure this whole thing out. And, I hope people don't feel like I'm doing it at the expense of their, you know, $3. You know, at the end of the day, hopefully some interesting work comes out of it, you know.
I think it's interesting-looking work. I think Dustin did a great job on that. Dustin McGuinn, a wonderful artist. It was another great project. And I also like, in the same way of The Intimates, too, the covers are so eye-catching. And don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of, even going back to the Silver Age, your classic Murphy Anderson or Jack Kirby-looking cover.
Sure.
That'll catch anybody's eye. But you know, it really seems like with The Intimates, and especially Wildcats, and especially those early issues, too, they really had a magazine-looking feel to them.
Yeah, I'm sort of a big graphic design nut, and on both of those series, we were privileged to get Ryan Hughes to come in, who is a fantastic artist in his own right, but also a great graphic designer, to come in and work with us on those series to really make them distinctive. Because comic books are art, and they should be, from top to bottom, looked at as a work of art. Whether or not you enjoy reading them or whatever, they should really be these great things to look at. It's not something that a lot of comics necessarily take into consideration, the areas that we explored graphic design-wise. So, you know, if I see sort of some unexplored territory, I'm happy to try to dive right in and see if I can, you know, mix it up a little bit.
And you speak of art, one collaborator that you had early on that always catches my eye when I see his work is Ashley Wood.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, I'll admit, Joe, unfortunately, as you say, some of your comics are cult comics, And there is such a glut of material that comes out. And I have to admit, I'm one of those people that missed Automatic Kafka.
Oh, well, and, you could blink and you miss that one. You know?
Well, it seems like it was a great 9 issues. And first of all, for those of us who did miss the series, let's get this out of the way. Will it ever see work as a trade?
Again, that's, you know, it's the whims of the corporation there. I mean, if DC deems to put out a trade, I mean, I think the thing could exist as a trade as for the art alone. It's just sort of an art book.
Sure.
Because, I mean, from you know, back to front, I mean, Ash did tremendous work on that series. I think some of the best comic book work he's ever done. It was that series in particular was something that, I mean, I look back on really fondly because, again, it's one of those things where, unlike even Wildcats and now The Intimates, yes, there was only 9 issues, but those 9 issues were me and Ash for all 9 issues,
mm-hmm.
whereas even, you know, Wildcats and The Intimates, you know, ended up having fill-in artists,
yes.
you know, for various reasons. So Automatic Kafka, at the end of the day, to me, is very much a much more pure endeavor because Ash and I both stuck it out for the entire 9 issues. And, you know, a lot of people look back fondly on that series, which is very gratifying. Again, talk about a cult book. I mean, that's your definition right there. Whereas the people who got it really, really got it. And the people who didn't, you know, they knew right away it wasn't for them, and they stayed away, and that's fine, too. But we had a blast doing it. I mean, Ash and I really, in a way, sort of lament that moment in time. And that's really what Kafka represents for me at this point, sort of this moment in time where, you know, an artist and myself really, like, bore down and were really in sync and were really getting off on what we were doing. And, you know, the fact that it had this mature readers label meant that we could really pull out all the stops. I mean, in a sense, I haven't had a book or an experience like that since then until now with Godland, with Tom Scioli. Now, obviously a different style and a different kind of comic, but in terms of the sort of the balls-to-the-wall freedom
mm-hmm.
that we have, those two series are very much sort of sister series to each other.
Do you see yourself pursuing more independent stuff and working more with Image, less than the big two now, Joe?
I think I've done a decent job of keeping one foot in each world,
mm-hmm.
fairly balanced. I mean, I get enough enjoyment, quite a bit of enjoyment out of writing the bigger characters, the franchise characters at either company, that I would miss it if I wasn't doing it. But if I was just doing strictly that, I would miss the freedom that I get out of co-creating my own things and putting out books that really are a more singular vision than just the next guy writing X franchise for one of the big publishers. But, I mean, one doesn't negate the importance of the other to me. I'm extremely lucky that I get to do both.
I want to say for Kafka, for those who haven't read it, can you give people a synopsis of the themes of the book?
Basically, Automatic Kafka is about a robot superhero who was big in the 80s, and we sort of were catching up to him after the fact. It's sort of a post-fame situation where not only do we see the Automatic Kafka character sort of try to come to grips with life after superhero celebrity, but we catch up with his whole supporting cast is all old teammates of his. And we sort of see where all these characters have landed. It's kind of an exploration of maybe 10 minutes of any behind the music special you're going to see on VH1, you know, the post drug, you know, post breakup, all that kind of stuff. And there was a bit of meta commentary going on. We did an issue where Kafka encountered all of the characters from the Peanuts cartoon strip all grown up. Now, this is not a new thing. I mean, there have been other strips that have done this before. Our take on it was, what happens to characters after their creator has passed away? Obviously, they live on, but how do they live on? What are they cast to the four winds when they don't have that guiding hand? At the end of the series, at the end of the 9th issue, Ash and I actually showed up in the comic to sort of take him away and say, look, we'd rather basically sort of erase you than let someone else get a hold of you and have their way with you, as it happens with all of these superhero characters. You know, I mean,
sure.
Bob Kane has passed away. Batman lives on. Jack Kirby's passed away. All of Marvel lives on.
Yep.
Now, are these characters better served by people other than their creators? You could argue both ways. In Automatic Kafka, we argue that the creator and his creation are intrinsically linked, and you shouldn't have one without the other. And that's really, that was sort of the ultimate statement of that book, which, you know, I was happy to make. It was sort of, again, within this corporate structure, because Kafka was this DC comic, it was flying that flag of singular creation and identifying creators with their creations so strongly that you can't have one without the other. I still reconcile that on characters like Spider-Man. I don't know if Spider-Man's ever been any better than when Steve Ditko was drawing him, you know?
No, I understand.
It was that kind of vibe for that book.
Sure, and I mean, or you get, you know, in the case of Batman recently, and we have an episode up on my website with Steve Englehart, coming back to, you know, his take on Batman, which was so successful and so lauded from the 70s on, and it's really interesting to see the reaction to Dark Detective compared to the post-Frank Miller Batman that everyone is so used to.
Right. I mean, and like I said, Kafka has a singular point of view. It's not necessarily my across-the-board view. If you take Batman, I mean, it's great to have guys like Steve Englehart being able to work on Batman, or Frank Miller for that matter, mm-hmm. because they do bring something to the table that gives people extreme amounts of pleasure. I mean, I love when Frank Miller does Batman. I mean, I would never want to begrudge myself or anyone else, you know, creators having their take on these classic characters. But with Kafka, we just took that sort of hard line of, you know, it's got to be the guy who created him. You know, it's got to be the creators and their creations, and never the two should part. And as a writer, my point of view about things shifts from project to project, and it'd be silly of me to sort of lock myself down to one point of view that applies to all of my work, because, you know, in such a diverse medium, to lock yourself down to anything is really, you're cutting yourself off from a lot of really great experiences.
And again, I mean, I'm surprised because a guy, again, as unique as Ashley Wood, and the success that he's seeing in all of his current projects going on and stuff, I just can't believe that DC isn't smart enough to realize this guy is so unique. You know, it wouldn't hurt to have a book reflecting when he was working for us.
Well, I think as time goes on, it's the interesting thing about a book like that is the legend seems to grow certainly more than it was when it was out. I mean, people certainly enjoyed the book, but once something is gone, and again, this is true for, you know, a few of my projects over the years, once something is gone, people tend to come out of the woodwork a little bit more and say, wow, that was a great book. Wow, I wish they'd collect that, or I wish I could get that still, you know, and it's a nice feeling. It's cool to be appreciate on any level, even if it's after the fact. I get a kick out of it when anyone ever says, oh yeah, Kafka, great book, I wish they'd collect it. And, you know, it makes the experience even more worthwhile.
You know, also I want to give a shout out to a buddy of yours, one of your Man of Action pals, and that's Joe Kelly, because I always felt Engine Head, that really interesting story, you know, kind of got quashed before it really had a chance to show the impact that it would have had maybe if it had been collected.
Yeah, I agree. That was a great book. It should be, between he and I, it should be a sort of a warning sign to all incoming creators, like robots at DC. I mean, it's a tough sell over there. You know?
Despite Robot Man.
And, yeah, exactly.
And the Doom Patrol, exactly. Let's switch and talk about Earth's Mightiest Heroes, your Avengers miniseries. They came at the end of the disassembled Bendis run. Quesada kind of built it as a Valentine to old line Avenger France, and I think you succeeded. I think you and Scott Collins gave us a great series and a retelling of the early days of the Avengers. And a couple things in particular that I really enjoyed about it was your take on Steve Rogers, Captain America, waking up to the end of the 20th century and coming to a very different world in 1999 than the original world he woke up to in 1963.
That was always the appeal to me about that character, the man out of time aspect, the fact that he's wearing the flag. Depending on how the culture is going, that's either a very incendiary statement to make, or it's, you know, I mean, they can go any number of ways depending on the mood of the culture. Captain America, he's just a great, fascinating character, but that aspect of, I mean, that to me is his most interesting time. It's just, you know, fresh out of the ice, so to speak. And the great thing about Earth's Mightiest Heroes for me is that because of the whole Zemo storyline and mm-hmm. discovering that Zemo's still alive and that Zemo had killed Bucky and all this kind of stuff, we were able to portray Captain America with an almost sort of Batman-like obsession that he certainly grew out of and became a sort of a more even-keeled and sort of respected figure. But we were able to play him as sort of really driven and really a bit unstable. I hadn't seen that in a while. I thought that was an interesting way to go with that character.
And then, of course, you know, your take on Hawkeye, and it was interesting to see all those hidden scenes that, you know, Stan, Jack, and Dick Ayers and, you know, didn't have the time or probably didn't have the interest back then to delve into. And there's a lot of subtext that you were really able to go after.
Well, the interesting thing about it is, I mean, this is kind of where I go back on everything I said about Kafka, because I'm just such an Avengers geek from just when I was a little kid, is that the first couple of years of the Avengers, the original comics, they're not necessarily Marvel's finest moment. I mean, they certainly don't hold up in the way that, say, early Fantastic Four's or certainly the early Spider-Man's hold up.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, but because of that, there's a lot of wiggle room in terms of being able to interject scenes that probably should have happened but just didn't happen because of the way they were telling the stories. And it was interesting that it came so late in the series, but I was like salivating to get to that point where we could show this whole sort of relationship between Hawkeye and Jarvis that, according to us now, had pre-existed before
mm-hmm.
Hawkeye shows up in the mansion and ties him up and tries to prove himself the Avengers. Well, to be able to tell that, well, not just to tell them, but create that backstory.
Sure.
That they had met each other and knew each other, and it was Jarvis who brought him in, and they pre-planned that whole meeting. That was a lot of fun. I that was one of the things I looked forward to doing the most. Because, you know, just as a fan, it's always fun to get in there and see how you can contribute to the canon and really add something to these characters that you've loved so much, you know.
Absolutely, and not to begrudge what Bendis is doing with New Avengers. I'm entertained by it, and it is something different, but I'm curious, with the response to Earth's Mightiest Heroes, it seemed to do very well. Is there another Avengers story in you, or have you talked to Joe Q or anybody else over there about possibly revisiting the Avengers?
I'm not much of a newsbreaker, but I can say that there's more in the offing. I think it's the best I can do at this point.
No problem.
It did do very well for Marvel, and they were very happy with it. And there's definitely more material to mine. And I would never turn down the opportunity to write the Avengers. I mean, that's the one that I would, sort of the cliche of what, you know, I'd write it for free. I'd write the Avengers for free. I just love that book and those characters. I mean, the classic characters so much that to just get to do the first Earth's Mightiest Heroes was a total dream come true. So there's definitely been talk to continue. I'm also doing a Fantastic Four project that's coming out starting in January that's very much in the same vein as Earth's Mightiest Heroes, and it explores the early days of the Fantastic Four. And it's being drawn by Chris Weston.
Oh, sure.
Who did Ministry of Space, did The Filth, Vertigo. And
great artist.
Oh, the pages, they are gorgeous. I mean, this is the best work of Chris's career, and I've been a fan of Chris's for years. But the stuff he's doing on this is just, I mean, it's funny because these kind of projects, I won't say they go below the radar, but because they're not sort of set in modern continuity and they don't impact the line at that moment, people don't tend to look at them, as I look at them, as sort of these prestige projects. They sort of look at them as sort of side projects, you know,
mm-hmm.
because most readers are really into the fix of, wow, what's happening in the Marvel Universe this month? And
yeah,
how are things being affected right now?
They like the soap opera.
Yes, exactly. So the kind of projects that I'm doing right now, like Earth's Mightiest and now the Fantastic Four thing, are, again, these opportunities to have these, you know, as you said before, these love letters to these characters. And to do it with the Fantastic Four and with Chris Weston, people are going to be shocked when the books come out at how great they look and the approach we're taking with it, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
I should ask before we move away from the Fantastic Four, you threw it out there, I haven't seen the movie yet, have you?
I have not seen the movie either.
Maybe we're both not seeing it yet for the same reasons.
Possibly. The thing is, though, I'm not really big on these comic book movies in general. I mean, it's great when they come out and they're well done, and it's certainly, you know, it's better to have a good comic book movie out there than a bad one. But for me, I'm perfectly happy with the comics and that being all there is, you know. I mean,
okay.
For people who've been reading comics for, you know, probably as long as we have, when you love it before there was ever really any movies, then the movie shouldn't make any difference one way or the other, you know?
Oh, sure, as far as the appreciation of the comic book.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, no, I understand that. But, you know, still, you certainly root for the movies. Everybody does.
Yeah, I don't want them to suck.
Of course not.
Don't get me wrong. Yeah.
No, of course not. I you know, what did you see Batman?
I did see Batman, yeah.
I like Batman. I agree with those who say that the last third kind of went down into a usual popcorn blockbuster kind of mode.
Right.
But I think the first two-thirds, you saw a really interesting characterization. I wouldn't have, you know, agreed with some of the changes had I heard about it beforehand, but it didn't bother me, and actually they all made sense.
Well, sort of to put on our, you know, our cinephile hats here, the interesting thing about Batman Begins for me is that unlike not just comic book movies, but most movies, where the second act is always kind of the act that drags or sags, and, you know, you're just trying to get from the beginning to the, you know, crash-bang ending.
Right.
With Batman Begins, the second act was the most riveting and the most interesting act in the film.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of movies in general that you can say that about, so that accomplishment alone, I tip my hat to those guys, because, you know, when I realized that we were in the third act and that everything was going to start to blow up, I was kind of sad, because I'd so enjoyed that middle bit that most, and like I said, it's not just comic book movies, most movies tend to falter in that second act. And Batman Begins had a really strong second act, probably the strongest act of the whole movie. So I enjoyed it as a film buff just on that level, you know. That really surprised me.
Can you point to any films of, you know, looking at your comic books, and are there any, like, touchstone films that maybe impacted a specific project in any way?
I guess there are films that I always go to for inspiration. I mean, things like Apocalypse Now is one of my favorite films.
Classic.
It's a bit of a stretch, but, I mean, you know, Apocalypse Now, I'm able to apply some of that to the G.I. Joe book that I'm writing at the moment.
Yeah, talk about G.I. Joe, American Elite.
Well, they came to me and they wanted to relaunch G.I. Joe, and so just, you know, it's sort of the typical game of a new number one will garner a lot of attention, or in this case, we did a zero issue.
Okay.
I mean, let's be upfront. That's what those things are for. And, you know, it's a better marketing hook than just how I used to know it. It's like, hey, new creative team comes on with issue, you know, 85 or whatever, and you
right.
go on from there. Now the whole game is, well, a new number one, and here we go, and everybody jump on board, you know. So whatever, you know, that's what they did, and so I was able to come in, and they asked me if I was interested, and I did a little reading. I was not a big on G.I. Joe, but I read all the issues of the previous run, and I realized, you know, there's some cool characters there, and there's I had some stories to tell, and they were amenable to my ideas. That's really the reason I did it. If I'd have pitched what my take and they'd said, we don't think this is right for what we want to do, I'd have said, okay, great, well, thanks for listening, and then definitely don't do what, you know, don't go with me as the writer. But they seemed to like what I'd come up with, so I feel like I have some creative stake in that book, and it does allow me to sort of tap into a bit of, you know, that sort of military fiction that I like in movies like Apocalypse Now and Full Metal Jacket and Platoon and all those kind of things. That's the vibe I sort of bring to it. Also sort of the characters and getting into those relationships maybe heavier than they've been in the past is also sort of a lure for me as a writer. You know, and we've gotten good response. I think people are really fans of those characters are really digging what we're doing.
I also wanted to get back to Batman for a second and acknowledge your two-parter with Cully Hammer, Tenses.
Oh, right, yeah.
Really neat story, and a story, too, that fit very well into kind of a good partner for the Batman movie. You wrote that several years before the movie came out.
Yeah. This is, again, now, here's where I'm a real genius, because that finally saw the light of day right as Jim Lee and Jeff Loeb's Batman was hitting and really, like, making an impact. So those guys took the approach that really the commercial approach of, it's, you know, it's all of Batman's villains and everything you love about Batman, the whole mythology all in this 12-issue run. Meanwhile, the genius me over here saying, I'm going to do a Batman story that has absolutely nothing about the Batman mythology. There's not even Alfred wasn't even in Tenses, you know. And that was my personal mandate. I said, look, I'm gonna do a Batman story like Stanley Kubrick would do a Batman story, which would be the most isolated thing. It would not sort of revel in the mythology and all the stuff that's around Batman, his rogues gallery, even the Bat Signal and Commissioner Gordon and all that stuff. I jettisoned all of that and said, can I tell a Batman story that sustains for, in this case, about 120 pages, that only deals with Batman. In a way, I mean, the Stanley Kubrick thing was very much on my mind at the time.
Okay.
In trying to sort of present this very almost cold version of Batman, this very distancing version of Batman, which, you know, I think it succeeded on that level, but talk about a project that was so not plugged into the zeitgeist of Batman at the time. I mean, we were just 180 degrees away from what people really wanted to see on Batman. So I'm proud of the work, but if part of my job is sort of trying to plug into to what people want out of these franchise characters, I missed the shot on that one. I mean, as much as I missed the shot on the X-Men, I really missed the shot on that Batman book.
Well, but I would also say that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that was set up not to be a prestige thing. That was originally going to be a Legends of the Dark Knight story, wasn't it?
Yeah,
well,
there it was.
Well, then that's perfect. And, yeah, now I understand what you're saying. But, again, Legends of the Dark Knight is an insular Batman book. It does occasionally have the rogues in it, but mostly it is, you know, year one Batman kind of, you know, dealing with the newness of having the job and coming together. And again, I think what you may have missed as far as what was going on in the comic books, indirectly, you're doing a Batman Begins story. I mean, it is Bruce Wayne coming back, learning the ropes of what's happening in his corporation and dealing with this very unique villain in this case. And I thought it was an excellent book. I thought Cully did a great job with the art, but I appreciated your take on it. And I'm a Legends of the Dark Knight kind of fan where, you know, if it's an interesting story, you know, I don't need Mr. Freeze to show up to make it interesting.
Right. And had it been a Legends of the Dark Knight story and you'd gotten it over six issues at, you know, $2.50 a pop, it might have, you know, not been as harshly critiqued as it was. But the fact that people put down, you know, I think $7 an issue, mm-hmm. I mean, people had the right to bitch and moan about, you know, what it was, because they were paying a lot of money to be able to bitch and moan. So I don't begrudge anyone who came away from that going, my God, what, they've really subjected us to this sort of very impersonal Batman story when you know, Jeff and Jim were giving us the Joker and Superman and, you know, all, you know, everything you want out of a Batman story. But, you know, I'll take those lumps. I mean, you take your shot, and what happens, happens. And, I am proud of the book, and it did accomplish the kind of story that I set out to do. But those experiences, I learn a lot in terms of the big characters at the big companies, what fans of those characters are usually expecting, and how to deliver on that level while also getting your own rocks off in a creative way about, you know, trying to be unique in some manner.
Okay, let's talk about a more personal character for you, and that's Code Flesh. I really enjoyed it, and, you know, I got the Planet Lair collection of stories, and I didn't see the first run. Where did Code Flesh originally appear?
It started at Image.
Okay.
Did about five of the stories at Image, and then we did another three for Robert Kirkman's little black and white company he had before mm-hmm. before he went mainstream. So
you and Charlie Allard.
Yeah. It was basically Charlie and I'd been a fan of Charlie's before I certainly went pro, and he was one of the guys that when I finally did turn pro, I sought him out and said, you know, I'm a fan of your stuff. We should work together, and we worked on little projects here and there. And as we got to know each other, our mutual admiration for Eisner and the Spirit
mm-hmm.
sort of came out. And when we had this opportunity to do these, they were really short stories, you know, because it started in a book called Double Image, which was a split book. And we did 11 pages, and then Larry Young did 11 pages.
Okay.
So we were able to sort of really get into that sort of Eisner short story vibe. It was designed to come up with a character that operate in that same sort of spirit milieu where hopefully we could come back to it, you know, years later, and that character would still be there and still offer us as creators something to come back to. And again, it's one of those things. I mean, people have responded to that book and really liked it, really liked the collection, and so it's something that Charlie and I are really proud of.
Well, I hope you guys are able to get back to it, because each story was great. And if you haven't checked it out, folks, the last story in particular was such an interesting way of presenting a narrative and I don't want to tip it, but I'll just leave it at that. And very clearly Eisner influenced, but just a really smart story and a really unique device on how to tell a story. I really appreciated it.
Well, I won't spoil it either, but I'm surprised that more people. I mean, I really talk about a left field influence. That story was born out of reading Chris Ware, and I mean
okay.
Novelty Library.
Okay.
So
wow.
he did sort of similar kind of formalist experiments like that, and no one, I imagine it's just because of the different audiences that possibly people who have read Code Slash probably maybe just didn't read Acme Novelty Library and weren't familiar with Chris Ware's stuff, which in my opinion everybody should be.
Well, he's a genius on his own, of course.
By far. So
Jimmy Corrigan is amazing.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it was one of those things where it was I'd seen a sort of a narrative trick, and I thought, well, I think I can extrapolate on that a little bit. And so that's where that last story came from.
Very cool. And again, I love the design, too, of Code Flesh as well, having a barcode, a universal price code mask.
Sure, yeah.
I think that's terrific. So was that Charlie's idea? Was that your idea?
That was my idea, and Charlie and I sort of bounced the design back and forth till we came to what was now seems very obvious. But it took a few tries for us to kind of think, you know, well, how would this work best, you know? I'm always kind of... You know, when you create new characters, it's always about trying to come up with things that sort of seem iconic right off the bat, seem like they've always been there. In Godland, Adam Archer's design, that sort of cosmic, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, godlike being design, is very simple, but it's in a way it's very obvious. But that obviousness, I think, is important when you're coming up with new characters because you want to breed that familiarity right off the bat and have people connect to it on a visual level, so that you're already over the first hurdle of introducing a new concept to readers.
Before we wrap up, I want to first talk about your column with Matt Fraction. It's very fun, and it's this very interesting dialogue back and forth as you guys tackle whatever issue you want to talk about that week.
Yeah, it can be kind of a minefield, but it's funny because I used to be the guy who would sort of spout off at the mouth and we sort of not caring of risk or really not caring what what damage it might do to my career. And I've kind of chilled out a bit, and Fraction's the guy that will really, like, you know...
He's the angry man.
Yeah, once more into the breach, my friends, and I'm sort of the calming voice, which, you know, it's certainly not what I'm used to, but it's really great. I mean, Fraction's just... really bright, great writer. I think we both get a lot out of that discussion. I mean, it's nice that people can sort of observe it as it's happening. But I think it's a pretty honest conversation between two writers, which is all that it was ever meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not trying to make grand statements or, you know, spout some definitive view of the world or the industry or anything like that. It's just two writers talking. You know.
Yeah, it's like a bar conversation.
Yeah.
And I'm in radio, and you know, and believe me, you know, obviously it happens in every industry, and I'm sure every bricklayer and janitor and waitress and radio person and you name it, executive, is having the same argument of, you know what I don't like about the company, or, you know, I wish the company would do this.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, aside from conventions and things like that, it's rare that that writers in particular, which is, you know, the experience I've had, where writers really talk about craft in a way that doesn't involve sort of posturing an ego, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
where you really just say, let's talk about this industry and how much we love it, and, you know, and how much we love the craft. And I mean, I love this life and I love the career that I have. I've downplayed it before in sort of my personal life, where you kind of go, well, yeah, I'm a writer, it's neato, you know, and it's great, but it really is just this tremendous privilege to do this, you know, for a
mm-hmm.
living.
Sure.
I'd rather own up to it in that way and have this kind of conversation with, you know, in this case with Fraction, where I'm able to go, you know, this is great stuff, you know, from even the problems that the industry might have. It's, you know, I still love the business. I love the life that I've made for myself through this business and through the work that I've done. And, It's just a great thing, and to be able to have a forum to talk about those things has been really great. And again, the response to the column has been pretty positive. I mean, we're not getting raked over the coals for it like I thought we might, So that's been pretty gratifying.
And if you step back for a second, I'll be curious about your perspective, but as a longtime reader, and I go back to, you know, 12-cent comic books, it seems like it's a great time right now in the industry. I mean, as far as there's a lot of really good product, and it also seems like with some of the smaller publishers, there's a lot of opportunity for you guys. If you can't get something with the mainstream guys, you can go across the street and get a good idea published.
Sure, absolutely. I totally agree. To get into sort of a basement tapes kind of mode here, the only danger is that the danger of this time period, I think, is there's too much emphasis on instant gratification. And that's one thing when you pick up a comic book and you want, you know, the bang for your buck, wherever it's coming from, whether it's from the mainstream publishers or from indie publishers, self-publishers, whatever. But beyond the work, the idea that I came up in comic books feeling like, as a writer, these are hard-won skills that you cultivate over years and years and years. And what I like about the industry right now is that there is all this opportunity, but at the same time, with the internet being how it is, and the intense scrutiny that is placed upon sort of brand new projects right out of the gate and brand new creators right out of the gate,
mm-hmm.
there's a danger there that new guys coming into the field can burn out way too quick because there's too much attention on their early work, maybe too soon. And they don't have the chance to develop without a million guys, you know, on the internet coming down on their heads and,
sure.
and tearing them apart, you know. And how are their skills going to be hard won if they're not allowed time to develop, you know? And it happens at the big companies too, where a new talent is brought in, and suddenly, you know, he's on a big book at Marvel or DC, and under this intense pressure from fans to deliver. And is the guy ready? Is he not ready? Well, we're going to find out, you know. Whereas 20 years ago, the pathway that I saw, that I thought I would take myself, was you come up to the independents and you hone your skills on books that probably hardly anyone was ever going to see.
Mm-hmm.
But you get better and you get better and you get better and you work your way up to a skill level where you can compete and be, you know, and really do things are contributing to the culture of our industry. So, I mean, not to get off on a rant there, but that's the only thing that I see as the potential downside of what is otherwise this great period of the medium, of the business that we're in, you know. But it's even when things seem really great, you got to be vigilant because this is a business that can spiral out of control and has several times in its history.
We're three variant covers away from it happening all over again.
Yeah, exactly, right.
I wonder sometimes if coming up through the independents, you know, the young writer isn't afforded the opportunity of learning from some of the mainstream guys that came before him in the old studio system that was in place when it pretty much was just DC, Marvel, and a couple others.
Well, you're absolutely right. It definitely is also sort of an every man for himself kind of environment. And sometimes that's good because, you build up your resilience and you build up your survival skills as a creator in this business. On the other hand, it is sort of a shame that it isn't that sort of hierarchy that can really be beneficial to people coming up in the business and learning from guys that are above them. And, you know, those guys that are up at the top not being threatened by the guys coming up in the ranks, you know, because really anyone who's in that, you know, Wizard Top 10 writers list or Wizard Top 10 artist list,
yeah.
you know, it's great and it's fine. But if you don't have that perspective of someday you're not going to be on that list and that there are guys that are, you know, young guys right now who will supplant you on that list, you're kidding yourself because that's the cyclical nature of this industry, you know, and
sure.
it's how it should be, I think.
I want to, before we finish, have you acknowledge Man of Action, your company that you have with Joe Kelly. Tell me all the creators that are involved with that. I know Steve Siegel, Joe Kelly, yourself.
And Duncan Rouleau is the fourth man.
There we go.
Yeah.
And what's going on with you guys?
We got our fingers in a lot of pies, I'm telling you. we have a show that we created for Cartoon Network that will be debuting next spring, I believe.
Okay.
And we just wrote, we rewrote the first X-Men Legends video game that came out last fall.
Yeah, congratulations on that, by the way.
Thanks, yeah, it turned out great. And, you know, there's always, you know, between the four of us, there's always kind of film and TV things that are flying around. So it's a really busy time for all four of us, you know. But it's a great time at the same time, you know.
So you've got Godland right now, mm-hmm. and wrapping up the Intimates.
Yep.
And of course, as you said, you've got the Chris Weston Fantastic Four thing coming up in the future.
Right. That starts in January.
Anything else you'd want to mention coming up?
Well, you know, G.I. Joe is out monthly right now.
Okay.
There are things that will be announced hopefully in the next couple of weeks or couple of months, like some more Marvel work that hopefully will people who enjoyed Earth's Mightiest Heroes should be hopefully happy to hear about that.
Well, that's great. We look forward to the announcements. And, Joe, I've taken you over the hour, and I apologize, and I appreciate your patience for an hour plus of conversation. I personally enjoyed it.
No, it's great. I loved it, too.
John Sutcher's here with a few more show notes. There's been some feedback on the last couple episodes of Word Balloon, and I like to, on these flashback shows, give you something new and acknowledge some of the talkback that I've been getting lately. Michael Lipinski on the Jeff Johns flashback episode, which focused a lot on the 52 project that was just getting started. I'm generally not a DC reader, but I did enjoy much of 52. It seems that so few of those concepts or characters seem to have stuck around or had great success given the high-speed superhero hamster wheel and subsequent events. But the interview really captured that moment in time in which the writer became king and the TV-styled writing room powwows were normalized in the Big Two. The architecture of entire universes resided in the hands of a chosen few. From the outside, it certainly seems like a creative and creatively competitive atmosphere that produced some great work and more cohesive lines of books. One drawback I can see is that since they have also become increasingly insular stories and distancing if the particular writer's overarching narrative, such as in Dark Reign or Blackest Night, isn't to one's taste. The pendulum swings, and I can see how interviews like those with Ethan Van Sciver and John Hickman may become the forecast of the next era. Mike, the only thing I would say is very few books really make it that spin out of events. And I honestly think you could look back at all of the events going back to Civil War, Infinite Crisis. I had this conversation in my comic book store the other day when someone said nothing spun out of Infinite Crisis. And I rattled off a bunch of titles that did come out of Infinite Crisis, but just didn't make it. Same goes with 52. Think of that new Infinity Incorporated that they tried to start with Steel and Peter Milligan writing, and it just didn't happen. As far as my conversation with Vanita Rogers regarding the changes at DC, Jason wrote to me and said, thanks for the great content, thanks for the eloquent talk with Vanita. As a fan, I don't particularly understand what all this means as far as the changes at DC Entertainment, other than it seems that they're sending a message that they still want to be about comics. To see Johns in a position that confers him creative clout across multimedia is exciting. I just want my non-nerd friends to enjoy these amazing characters and this fascinating mythos. As Vanita pointed out, it's great to see comic guys with decision-making power. It gives me a feel of vindication. We won. We finally won. I've been stretching my podcasting wings and heading over to Around Comics' final few tapings the last couple weeks. In fact, as I release this show, there's going to be a taping today, Friday night, at Dark Tower. So if you're in Chicago, you may want to stop on by and check it out over on Western Avenue, Dark Tower Comics. Taping usually starts around 7:30 or 8 o'clock. And it's been a lot of fun, and I've had a lot of fun with the Around Comics guys. They've become very good friends of mine. And thank them, as always, for the opportunities to jump on and talk. And with Caters in Massachusetts and Sal stepping back, so I was very happy to jump in. For the people that are looking for more opinion on my show, I think you got a taste of it last week when I spoke with Vanita. That's when that talk comes out. Case in point, these two episodes of Around Comics, where not only do I talk, but I also break into a few voices here and there. We talk about the controversy in Captain America in this week's episode, in issue 602. And, of course, a very familiar conservative appears and gives his opinion. I hope you'll listen. Jonathan Conrad says, I say bully all you want, John. I love your insights when you pop up on Around Comics. Tom Kelly, a great Chicago cartoonist and web comics. Every now and then I catch you doing a radio commercial, and it's kind of weird. I think of you as such a comic guy, I totally forget about your day job. Thank God for the day job. Pays the bills. Keep up the great work. He says, I love your Rush Limbaugh that you did on Around Comics, which was very kind. Thank you. Charles Rubble on Facebook wanted to comment on my interview with Vanita and said, thanks a lot for Word Balloon, John. As long as you keep doing these interviews, I will certainly do my part and listen to them. And Vanita is very cool, too. Great conversation. Nick Graham wanted me to come to Planet Comic Con, which is the Kansas City convention. All the KC guys are going to be there. And KC isn't too far of a drive from Chicago. I agree, Nick. Problem is, I've got such big convention plans coming in April. WonderCon in San Francisco and C2E2 in Chicago. And I hope to meet more Word Balloon listeners there. It's always a pleasure to meet you guys in person. And thank you for listening to the show. And thank you for chiming in on these posts. I really appreciate it. Haas Pashel on Facebook asks, how about another Dwayne McDuffie interview about Justice League Crisis on Two Earths? By the way, have you heard the latest Sidebar interview with Dennis Cowan? It's great. Sidebar, if you guys aren't aware of it, excellent podcast that focuses on art. And I really got to hand it to these guys. Really good questions. They know their stuff. They know art. And always an informative interview. And I really think it's one of the better interview podcasts about comic books out there. Check out Sidebar. It's a very, very good show. And Haas, I will say that I love speaking to Dwayne, and I will be happy to try and get in contact with him. I feel bad that it isn't to promote the DVD. I reached out to Warner Video, and I should have gone to the guys directly. And honestly, they have been so kind to me to provide the guests from the Batman Brave and Bold cartoon. But you're right. Dwayne has not been on for a long time. It'd be great to talk to Dwayne again. Dave Ferguson liked my conversation with the creative team of Billy Batson and the Magic of Shazam, Art Baltazar, Franco Aureliani, and Mike Norton. And David says, another great interview. Makes me want to buy the guest's work. You'll make me a pauper, John Suntress. Hey, man, their first book is already out on the racks. Make sure you check it out. Billy Batson and the Magic of Shazam. Mike is taking the art in a very different direction. And it's a great all-ages book with Art Baltazar, Franco Aureliani, and Mike Norton. So that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Two quick reminders. There are question and answer threads out there at wordballoon.com and also at my Word Balloon message board at jinxworld.com. Questions for Jeff Loeb, questions for Matt Fraction. We're going to do Q&A, fan Q&As with those guys later on in the weeks ahead. So Q&As with Fraction and Jeff Loeb at wordballoon.com and at the message board. Thanks for listening to this edition. John Suntress reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the internet. Look for us at iTunes. Subscribe to our RSS feed. Make sure you don't miss an episode. Also, come to wordballoon.com. Check out the archive. We've got interviews going back to 2005 in some cases. More of the flashbacks from those early months of Word Balloon will be coming in the weeks ahead. Lots of good stuff. In fact, I think I'm probably going to do Keith Giffen next. A great conversation that we had in early 2006. But it's the fifth anniversary of Word Balloon coming up in May, and it's just my way of saying thanks, and more fun as well as Word Balloon celebrates its fifth anniversary. In the weeks ahead, don't forget I'll be at WonderCon, and I will be at C2E2 in Chicago. I hope to see you there. Until next time, as always, thanks for listening. More March Madness on the way. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.